I always revisit the reason why I entered journalism. It is to tell stories of people that are not represented in the mainstream media. People who look like me, people who talk like me, and people who I love, because I don't see them represented. And that's the reason why I wanted to be a journalist, because if they don't do it, then maybe I will do it.
Arvin moved to Canada from the Philippines 11 years ago. He came to live with his mom, who had moved here several years prior. Leaving his life in the Philippines behind, Arvin worked through his transition into life in Canada with his mom's support and encouragement to dream big. Welcome to The Safe Haven, a space for stories to be shared about the lights and darks, highs and lows of life. In this lively conversation, Arvin shares many personal experiences along his journey into journalism and as a journalist today. He talks about what being a person of color was like both in university and what it's still like today in the industry, and how a person's voice can be such a tool on the job. Arvin has worked so hard to chase his own personal dreams as a journalist while exploring areas that are both fun and of interest to him. He aims to show other journalists and people of color that you can be what you've always dreamed of being. We even talk about where journalism meets drag in Arvin's career as he tells us about some experiences from his time reporting on Canada's Drag Race, how contestants are treated in race, sobriety, and how he feels really blessed for these opportunities meeting the queens and watching their growth throughout filming the show. We start with a basic introduction before we dive in.
So my name is Arvin Joaquin. I moved to Canada 11 years ago. In 2009, I moved from the Philippines. I moved as a teenager, and I'm part of this generation. We call it like the 1.5 generation of immigrant, where you like spend a lot of your life in another country and then pretty much spend the rest of it in another. I moved here with my dad because my mom's been working as a live-in caregiver in Alberta. And then they moved to Vancouver. And then my dad and I moved to Vancouver to meet her and like live with her. But like that did not work out. Because I think that it's very normal to like, it's not normal, but it's very known in like the community almost, like in the Filipino diaspora, that most of the time when like a husband or a partner or a spouse like moved to Canada to be with their family, there's just a lot of like differences because of the years that they were apart. So my family is part of that statistic. Yeah, and then after that, like, so pretty much like I grew up in a single parent household. It's just me and my mom. And my mom, like, she's amazing. Like, she just let me pretty much do whatever and to dream big. And first, like, she wanted me to be a nurse, but I'm stubborn. So I told her, no, I don't want to be a nurse. That's such an expected thing for a Filipino to do. And my mom is a nurse. So a lot of respect to nurses, but that I don't want to like follow that path with like my mom and my aunt. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to be a journalist. And here I am.
Okay. There's a lot to unpack here already.
Okay. Let me know. Was that okay?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yes. I'm so excited. Okay. I want to jump back to 2009 when you moved from the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was just a matter of getting your family back together. Or like, what was the initial push or pull to come to Canada?
So my mom moved to Canada in 2003 when I was 13, and she worked in Alberta as a live-in caregiver. And so when she, when it's eventually time for her to apply for permanent residency, she had the option to take her family with her. And so she applied for a visa, like to bring us here. It's mostly for family reunification. And to, because I'm an only child, and to give me a better life, like quote unquote, a better life. And so that was the idea. And for my parents, they got married like young because my mom was 21. My dad was 19 when they got married. So that was the idea, just for us to be here together and to give me a better chance at life.
Mm-hmm. And what did your dad do back in the Philippines?
My dad is a jack of all trades, pretty much. Like, yeah. He hopped from like a business venture to another business venture. But like, it's all like, not like a big, like, oh my gosh, I'm a CEO, but like, it's like small businesses, like selling stuff from home to like raising pigs.
No way.
Oh yeah. Like, I grew up like surrounded by like animals. So, and it's not even a farm. So I don't know.
I love it. Okay. So from 2003 to 2009, you guys were essentially separated, right? Your mom was here working as a live-in caregiver in Alberta. And then you and your dad were back in the Philippines.
My family is very interesting too, because my mom is in Canada. My dad is in the Philippines with me, but I actually live with my grandparents in a different city away from my dad. Oh. So, yeah, so pretty much my mom, my dad, and myself were all separated. I was with my grandparents, my dad lives by himself, and my mom is in Canada. And so in 2009, when we had to be back together and be a family, it was very challenging.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. You just mentioned your grandparents, and I read an article that you had written about the live-in caregiver program being so far away from aging grandparents, right? And from your aging grandma. I would love it if you would just kind of elaborate a little bit of that.
I grew up with my grandparents. So pretty much my grandma and my grandpa, they were my parent figure, because my mom is in Canada, my dad is in another city in the Philippines. And so, like, I always tell my friends that I feel like I never really lacked that parental figures in your life, because I have my grandparents. And then when I moved here, it's a very interesting change, because like, now my grandma is away. My grandpa passed away a year before I moved to Canada. And then I realized that there's just like something about distance. It was different with like, my mom was away and my dad was away because I had my grandparents, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But then when I was here with my mom and everyone was so busy, just working hard to send money back home, I realized that like, there's just that disconnect almost to like the love and care that you could provide someone you care about when you're beside them. And there's really like something about distance that like, even back in February of this year, my grandma fell. And then it just like put everything into perspective. Oh my gosh, she fell. She's alone. What now? She's really far away. Sometimes like, you could, sure, like we're here and we could like send her money, but it's like really different to care for an aging and ill family member. And so that's...
Mm-hmm. With the distance, absolutely. And I feel like now more than ever, mm-hmm. it's like when you're told that you can't have something or that you can't do something, there's something in you that just wants to do it more or have it more, you know?
Yeah.
I can speak to being far away from my family. That's only just on the other side of the country. You know, I could still, ultimately, I could travel to see them. However, international travel, that's not a thing.
No, it's very pricey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So getting her here or you guys being there isn't an option?
My grandma, she's a very strong, firm woman. We tried to like ask her to visit us or even like live with us. A lot of my aunts are here as well, so her daughters, and they asked her like years ago if she want to come. But then she's like, no, I have weak knees, and if I move there, I'm going to die.
Okay.
Like, and we're like, okay, that's the end of conversation. Let's not push it.
Yeah.
And so she like, because she loves it there, like pretty much she spent her entire life in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And the weather, she's old. She's 91.
And if she's happy there, then that's the best place for her.
Yeah.
What were some of your biggest challenges coming here? I'm always so interested when you hear of people moving to Canada, especially from somewhere like the Philippines. What were some of your biggest challenges?
My biggest challenge when I moved to Canada was just finding like social connections. Back in the Philippines, I've always been part of like groups. I have a huge like group of friends. It's very big in the Philippines. Plus, like my cousins are there. Like Filipinos, like we're very known to extend our families, and so like you're not just like a unit. You grew up with your cousins most of the time. So that was me. I'm surrounded with my cousins, surrounded by friends. And so when I moved here, it was suddenly like, it's just me and my mom and my dad. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty much strangers living in a home.
Yeah.
Because it's been a while, like it's been a long time. And so now suddenly I have like these rules by my actual parents telling me to like go to bed early. But then I was also 18. So it's kind of awkward to have this relationship almost, like being forced at the time. So that was one of the biggest challenges. Plus, like, I did not have any friends. Mm-hmm. So my aunt, she had a daughter. I mean, she has a daughter that's way younger than me, but she's the only like family member that I could like hang out. And so it's just me and this little girl. So I don't. So that was like a very interesting time.
I guess so. Yeah. And I feel like going to a new country where so much culturally and linguistically is so different, right? And then at that age, so you said you were 18?
Yes.
That's a transitional time, transformative time in your life.
It is very.
So were you like, you're done high school, you're finishing up your last year. What was education like then?
My friend and I, who moved around the same time as me, and she's the same age, we call it, we moved here in a very awkward time and a very awkward stage.
Yeah.
Because at the time in the Philippines, it was a different education system. Like they just adapted the K-12 education system. So when I was in the Philippines, we graduate high school at around 15 or 16, and then we go to university. And so at the time, I spent 2 years in university. And so when I moved here, they're like, ooh, but it's not grade 12.
Yeah.
So I had to like take exams and take tests before I could go into college and eventually university. So I lagged behind, and it does something in your psyche as well, because like I go on social media and I see my peers back in the Philippines that like they finished school, they were graduating, and then meanwhile I'm still confused on what the next steps will be for me.
Mm-hmm. Is that kind of when you had made the decision that you weren't going to be going into nursing and that you really wanted to chase journalism?
It's so funny because I've always wanted to be a journalist. So back in the Philippines, I'm part of this pool of young student journalists from my school, back in elementary school, back in high school. And I've always wanted to be a journalist that in university, like when I was applying for university in the Philippines, I decided, okay, I think like for context, when you apply for schools in the Philippines, you just don't send an application. You have to like take an exam, and you have to pick a first choice, second choice program. And then based on your score, like they assign the program that you qualify in. So that's what you take. So when I was looking for like universities, when I was in high school, I had a lot of like science related programs, because at the time I told myself I wanted to be a doctor. So, and then there's one university, and I chose an arts degree, mass communication. And because like in my heart, I was like, oh, I really wanted to be a journalist. Let's just try. And then I qualified for all like the pre-med programs, but then I also qualified for the arts program. And then I realized, I was like, you know what? I'll go there. And so I went to the university. I tried to like be a journalist, but then my grandpa got ill. So I had to go back to my hometown, because it's in another part of the Philippines. I had to go back to my hometown and pretty much just like spend my time with my grandpa and also wait for our visa to come to Canada. And so I put that in like the back burner. Like that was like me in the past, but then I had this vision, whatever. Like, you know, when you're 18 and you just like fantasize that this will be your new life.
Oh yeah.
And so when I moved to Canada, I was like, okay, this is a new me. This is my rebrand. And I am surrounded with a lot of Filipinos. And they told me that, why not nursing? And I was like, true, why not nursing? Like once upon a time, when I saw my mom working as a nurse, I fantasized being a nurse as well, because like, I like the white uniform.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
clean. Yeah. And then I told her, I was like, oh, like maybe I'll be a nurse. But then it's just not me. And so I took a lot of like communication courses. Yeah. And then I realized like, I really want to be a journalist. Maybe I won't be a nurse, but I can tell stories about nurses.
Yeah, absolutely. You can totally overlap those. I love that you chased your dream though. It takes courage to do that, especially when you feel like there's expectations that have somehow been put on you.
Oh yeah. Especially like for like, I think the Filipino culture in general, because I feel like in the diaspora, when you move here, it's mostly whatever the culture's version of success is. Mm-hmm. And when I was chasing it, I realized that I wasn't really like falling into that mold. And so people always ask me like, why? Like, what's your job after that? When I was in university, they always ask me, what's next for you? What job will you have? But I feel like I've always been stubborn, mm-hmm. because, and I've always been firm. Whenever I like something or I really want something, I put my heart into it and just do it.
Yeah.
If it fails, then like it's a learning process. But if I succeed, then maybe it's worth it. I told you earlier, like my mom, I think early in life, because like she was there, I think she just realized that I'm that kind of kid. Mm-hmm. And so she just told me like one expectation from my mom. She told me that once you move here, I know that you've been jumping from like course to course, program to program, dream to dream. Just finish one degree and like do it well. And yeah, that was just my brief. And I think I delivered.
Yeah, I would say so. I'm so curious now on your journalism journey. So you've done the program, you enjoyed it clearly because you're still in journalism.
It's a very interesting thing too, like journalism, because so I moved to Vancouver and then I studied communication at SFU because I thought that that'll lead to a journalism career. Because in the Philippines, when you study communication, it's journalism. Mm-hmm. But that was not the case. But I learned a lot. It was a very nice like foundation course. And so I took a year off and then I realized that, oh, maybe I'll go to grad school and then pursue a master of journalism. And that's what I did. It was very interesting though, because I always tell my friends that journalism is the kind of profession that it's mostly for kids who are allowed to dream, mm-hmm. and who could afford to dream, because you know, like the state of the journalism industry in this country, pretty much a lot of jobs are precarious. Like you have to like pay your dues. You have to like move to rural areas to like pay your dues there before you could get a gig in a bigger market. And so there's just a lot. And also like unpaid internships. I was very fortunate because I did a lot of unpaid internships while I was in school, but I lived with my mom for free. And so I saw like a lot of my peers who were struggling because like, sure, you could get an unpaid internship with a big organization, or you can get a paid internship with a smaller organization. And going to a big organization will lead to more opportunities. But then if you can't afford an unpaid internship, your options will be limited. Mm-hmm. And so that's why like it's a very like tricky profession or industry, if you say, because I think it's truly for people who can afford the dream.
Journalism is always something that intrigued me and I was mm-hmm. so keen on it. And I even know as an adult, like in my mid-20s, I was applying for journalist jobs because I'm like, yes, I want this job, or like travel journalism, or just reporting in some of the places that I was traveling around to, or how neat it would have been to have done that freelance style, right? Reporting. So I think it's kind of funny that I ended up as a podcast host because you actually get to have that interaction with people. But I think it is so, so neat. You are able, like the way that you said about dream big and that it's a dreamer's job, it definitely is, because you've had the time to think about exactly what it is you want to do. And then you get to hone in on that. But it's like an artist, the struggling artist, the starving artist, right? The broke artist, because it's the dream and the love and the passion that ultimately keeps you alive and keeps you afloat.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And also, yeah, that's why like, and it's a very interesting industry to be in as a person of color, because as I mentioned earlier, it's very, most of the time you're not allowed, or you don't have the time to really sit there and dream, because you're new to this country. Pretty much you have a lot of priorities before this one. So, you know, like you have to, what, like find money for rent, money for groceries. Like there's just a lot of like things before you're allowed to, oh, like sit there and be like, oh, I want to be this.
Mm-hmm. So interesting that you mentioned just about being a person of color in media, because a while ago, I can't remember the exact date of it, but Frequency Podcast Network has a podcast called The Big Story, and Jordan Heath Rawlings did one on how Canadian media's whiteness fails all of us. And it was fascinating to listen to about how not only is it a dog eat dog type industry, but about how so many Black, Indigenous, and people of color are just kind of put to the sidelines based on jobs.
That's very true because, no, it's a very interesting industry because I feel like there's this idea of it's based on meritocracy, but it actually isn't because there's also bias towards Black, Indigenous, and people of color because people think that we can't do stories without inserting our identities and mm-hmm. having that lean, like the slide towards pretty much like, as they call it, like we have an like quote unquote agenda in the stories we tell, which is really not true. Because I think like as a white journalist, you just go in the job and be objective and whatever objectivity is for you and just present the story and people will not even question your slight or your bias because people will just see you as this neutral authority. Mm-hmm. But as Black, Indigenous, and journalists of color, we go into space and people already assume that we have a slut. And so we have to overcome that in order for our stories to pretty much be legitimized and be considered valid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's exactly what they talked about. So for anyone listening that is super interested in that perspective, definitely check that out. It really opened my eyes to it. And then because over the last couple months in particular, I've been doing a real deep dive in a really looking at things critically, and that includes the media and journalism and looking at race and really taking a bit of an inventory as to who's included in each industry. It's pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, it is very eye-opening. It's very interesting, too, that you mentioned that because when I was in journalism school, all of this that we talk about, the whiteness of Canadian media, the whiteness of media in general, you see that in journalism school because journalism school is a microcosm of the entire industry. These are future journalists that will actually be part of this bigger organization. And seeing that in journalism school was actually trippy, just being part of it. And so I'm personally like, I heard a lot of stories. I lived it. When I was in journalism school, one of the professors asked me if I was an international student for the entire school year. And so every time like that prof sees me, he'll be like, oh, are you the international student of the cohort? And then at first I just like laugh it off because I think that's the person of color's response. Like mm-hmm. you just like laugh it off like awkwardly because you don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then that happened again and again and again throughout the school year.
With the same prof?
Same prof. And so I told him, I was like, no, still not the international student, still from Vancouver. Yeah, and so like stuff like that and a lot of like microaggressions in class as well, like towards my Black peers. I heard people saying the N-word in class and I saw like my friends just shut down because like, is this real life? Like, what is going on? Yeah. And so I like having like that environment, I actually questioned if I really want to be part of this industry mm-hmm. because I just felt that I felt like an outsider because not only that I'm a person of color, but I'm also queer. So I have a lot of intersections in my identity that mm-hmm. I don't know if journalism is ready for that yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this summer, I'm part of a group of students and alumni who wrote a bunch of call to actions towards our the university we attended to pretty much just remind them to do better and to maybe revisit some of the protocols that are in place to make this space better for Black, Indigenous, and people of color who want to be a journalist because this is their introduction to journalism.
I love this. Mega, mega congrats on that because that is so freaking necessary. And I really hope that that program will become more of a welcoming, brave, and inclusive space because it needs to. It's so long overdue.
It does. And it also trains non-BIPOC journalists or white journalists to think critically mm-hmm. because a lot of times, like as I mentioned earlier, these are the exact same people who will be journalists one day. And they will run the industry and they will have the call. Like they can make the call. either changing the industry or just keeping it as is. Mm-hmm. And if they keep it as is, it's really not a safe space for BIPOC journalists.
No. Have there been other challenges that you have experienced in the journalism industry as your career has progressed?
Not in the journalism industry, but when I was defending my thesis when I was in school, because not growing up in Canada, people always like make comments on your English or your accent or whatever. And it's a very important tool for journalists, just your speaking voice and whatever. Or they say it's a very important tool. But I had a very traditional like prof when I was recording my podcast, and he told me that the content was good, everything is engaging, but I mispronounced some words because maybe I'm ESL. And then at the time I was like, oh, maybe like this is for me, because like at the time I was already freelancing. Mm-hmm. I worked on The Hill in Ottawa, and all that insecurities from 2009 just like came back, and I was like, oh, maybe I don't belong here because maybe my voice is not suited for anything. So it was very disheartening, but my supervisor at the time, he was a very kind man. He told me after the defense, he was like, that comment about your accent and you mispronouncing stuff, I'll respectfully decline, or I'll respectfully ignore. That's what he said.
We like this guy.
We like this guy.
Yeah.
Like and then after that, I was like, I'll embrace it. I mean, at the end of the day, it's your voice. It's the sound of your voice. Just embrace it. At least it sounds like you, mm-hmm, and not anyone else.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I have so much appreciation for that comment. And especially now tying back to the conversation that I had with Eternity Martis, because when she mentioned, even in her book, and I think we talked about it briefly in the podcast, was about how she would change how she spoke. And I've read about this. I've heard all about this. I've listened to podcasts a little bit about this, about code switching, about how people put on a voice or slight accent to fit into a role. And for me, I've never had to even think about that, right? And there's the privilege coming through. But honestly, when I hear people talk about their real world personal experiences, wow.
No, it's very true. Like you have, we call it editing. You have to edit the way you present yourself, the way you talk, the way you enunciate things. It's so funny because when I was in journalism school, you actually feel like they're turning each and every one of you into the exact same product.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't fit the mold, they pretty much just don't give you the attention that the other people get, because they were being groomed to be the next quote unquote big stars of journalism. So if you don't fit the mold, you just, I guess, thrive on the sidelines, and yeah, and you find ways, mm-hmm, to still make it, at least using your own voice this time, mm-hmm, because I will never fit that mold.
I just love that you've persevered.
Yeah.
I admire you, and I really admire your perseverance and resilience through that, because it shows that you're in what you're doing because you absolutely, wholeheartedly, to your core, love it.
I do. And I always like revisit that idea. Like sometimes, like someday, for example, that day when the prof told me that maybe because I was ESL, I had doubts and I questioned if this is really the industry for me. But then I always revisit the reason why I entered journalism. It is to tell stories of people that are not represented in the mainstream media. People who look like me, people who talk like me, and people who I love, because I don't see them represented. And that's the reason why I wanted to be a journalist, because if they don't do it, then maybe I will do it.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that theme a lot about how if you don't see it, how do you know that you can be it?
Yeah.
So you're the people that others are seeing.
Yes. And I'm trying to be a good role model or, mm-hmm, something. Not a role model. I feel like role model is just too like, you know, yeah, but like, you know, just like someone that that's there to remind them that you can do it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a question that I had written down about Canada's Drag Race and the coverage of that and how you got into that, because I feel like that's been a lot of the last little bit of your life.
Yes, it's been a while. It's so funny because when I was in journalism school, like we talk about, like my friends and I remember before I decided to become a journalist, my friends and I always like watch Drag Race, RuPaul's Drag Race. And then when I decided to apply for journalism schools, my friends were like, so are you covering Drag Race? And I was like, no, I'm trying to be like, you know, like just do public service. like quote unquote serious journalism. But when I worked at Extra Magazine, there's this opportunity to explore the world of drag. And it's not just limited to RuPaul's Drag Race or the franchise, including Canada's Drag Race, but truly like to explore drag in general. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like how the show treats its like contestants of color, the like queens who are not white, drag and sobriety, RuPaul in general. And so I'm very happy, and I was blessed to do coverage and cover Canada's Drag Race, because I feel like I'm invested, and I was invested in the queens because I've met them before the show aired and during filming, and just seeing them grow almost like every single week that I follow the show was, it's very surreal, because I've seen them when they were just there and they were aspiring to be pretty much the next big thing in drag. And yeah, I enjoyed working and I enjoyed doing that part of my job. It's nice.
I bet. I love that it also looks at the culture in total, but also sobriety and how the BIPOC community is treated within. I think that that's really neat that you were able to kind of investigate that.
Yeah, it's a very like interesting issues in the queer community in general and Drag Race specifically, because I feel like people always talk about Drag Race and they just think, oh, it's just a TV show. But it is actually a cultural phenomenon. It affects the culture. It exposes lives from like people who are historically like not talked about. But I feel like any other product of the media, you really have to be critical on what you consume. And so Drag Race provides entertainment. I love it. But at the same time, it'll be naive to ignore the issues in the show. Pretty much like how Black Indigenous people of color, like mostly Black queens in the show, were treated. They were called aggressive, all the microaggressions they endure. Yeah, so because it's such a big like part of the queer culture now. So I feel like if once we like shed light to those issues, I think we could appreciate the show more and even like question some of the things that are shown on Drag Race.
Mm-hmm. I'm so intrigued. And looking at it as a whole and as a culture and as a way of living.
Yeah, it's true, because like most of the times, like the queens on the show, they were queens who worked in bars, like the typical, pretty much the typical staple of the queer community. Mm-hmm. And then from bars to the main stage to like touring the world, that's such a big change to like someone's life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because like RuPaul is everywhere. I mean, RuPaul's Drag Race is everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to come back to like, you've navigated some pretty mega transitions in your life and in your career and in your personal life. I want to know a little bit about some hobbies or personal practices that you have that help you maintain your best self.
Oh my gosh. I love reading. It's staying in bed a hobby, because I during my days off, I just stay in bed and just like stare at the ceiling. I don't know. That sounds so bad, but I feel like
that's good reset.
And that's such a, and you like, you heard it here first. I'm kidding. No, that's it. Yeah, I just like stay still, stay in bed, eat food, that's really it. I don't know if that's even a hobby as much as a reset.
Yeah.
But
personal practices, like what would an ideal morning look like for you?
My ideal morning, I love to take it slow. Mm-hmm. I don't like getting up in bed like right away and then do shower. I like to like wake up and then just stay there until I'm ready to leave, mm-hmm. which is not good sometimes when I have to go to work, but I do that. But like ideal morning, just leave bed when I want to, and then have a cup of tea and read a little or like check social media. And then, I don't know, and stay in bed.
And you mentioned reading too. If you're staying in bed, like, do you read when you're laying in bed?
I do. I read, and it ranged from like from romance novels to like serious books, whatever that serious book is.
What are you currently reading?
I am currently reading the compilation of the 2019 Best Magazine Pieces. So I feel like it's not a huge like investment of time because it's very like short, and there's a lot of things in the book because it's a compilation.
Yeah. Okay. I have three safe haven style questions for you.
Let's do it.
Okay. What are you most proud of?
I think I'm most proud of what I achieved in my journey so far. Because I think moving here from the Philippines, I just thought that I have to reset my life and find a new dream. But I actually chased my childhood dream and I'm living it. And sometimes I still pinch myself. But yeah, I'm very proud of that I did that for myself. And I'm very proud of my mom. She's a single parent and she's been with me throughout the journey. Even from like me as a university student, both of us going to Ottawa and looking for an apartment on the fly, helping me move in Toronto. So yeah, and I'm so proud of her for just doing it because she did that.
Mm-hmm. She's in your front row cheering you on always.
Always.
Oh, I love that. What would you like to be known for?
I want to be known for as someone who just did his best. I think that's it. Like I want to be known for as someone who always tried.
Can I add a point B into that
one?
What holds you back from being your best?
Before I think it's societal pressure and like what people expect me to be. But now I feel like nothing because I think I can do it. And is that like false security? I don't know, but I feel like I can just do it.
I love it. I can't stop smiling. Okay. And then if you had a message for everyone listening, what would it be?
Always stay true to yourself. And never give up on you, because at the end of the day, like a lot of things will change, but if you are you and you embrace your imperfections, your quirks, that will be your superpower. Yeah. And then you'll slay.
Yes. Oh, Arvin, I'm loving this so much. If anyone listening is keen on following your journey, where can they find you on social media?
They can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Arvin Joaquin.
Okay. And I will link that at the bottom so that people can find you easily. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Amanda. It's been a pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's all mine.
Arvin, what an amazing conversation. I really appreciate you and your time. Your perspectives and experiences have given me so much to think about, and I thank you for it. To everyone listening, I recognize the privilege that comes with my platform, and I am committed to creating a safe, brave, and inclusive space with intention. If this episode has hit you right in the heart or inspired you in any way, please screenshot the screen while you're listening, send it to your friends, and share it on your Instagram stories. please be sure to tag us so that we can personally thank you for it. If you're able to write a review or leave a juicy 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, that really helps this podcast grow. If today is the start of your journey into the depths of anti-racism, learning and unlearning of old ways, be kind to yourself. Try not to feel burdened by shame or guilt. Keep moving, keep growing, keep leading with love, and I will talk to you next week.